Intervju Radija Študent.
Tim Burn je ameriški džezovski saksofonist, ki ima za sabo že čez 40 albumov. Med drugim znanimi imeni sodobne džezovske in širše scene svobodomiselne godbe. Letos je, kar je marsikoga presenetilo, izdal album kompleksnega, strukturiranega komornega džeza pri znameniti založbi ECM. Imenuje se Snack Oil in Tim Burn ga bo danes zvečer predstavljal oziroma razširjal v klubu Cankarjevega doma. Pred nastopom je odgovoril na nekaj vprašanj o začetkih in mogočih nadaljevanjih.
The first question has to be. It has to be the story about your beginnings, the story how you first bought your saxophone.
Oh, that's the first question. Okay.
Yes. Tell me about
it. I was
in
college and I hurt my ankle. I was playing basketball, not professional, you know, just like for what they call intramural basketball.
Mm-mm.
And so I was bored, and then I heard that somebody was selling their saxophone for, I think it was $100.
Yeah.
So I bought it. I thought, oh, this will be interesting. You know, I was into music, listening as a listener. So I bought this saxophone, and then I noodled around on it and stayed interested.
Were you,
I'm not talented. I have no musical ability at all. I was the only one in my family who didn't play an instrument.
I see.
Yeah.
But have you started developing an interest in jazz right away?
Yeah,
the moment you bought the saxophone?
As a listener, yes. You know, I was into all kinds of stuff. I used to go to the Village Vanguard, you know, drive there, and I'd heard, you know, like Keith Jarrett band, and I heard everybody, Sun Ra, Cecil Taylor, Sonny Rollins, you know, all kinds of stuff. So I definitely was into music, you know. And then I thought, oh, it's only $100, we'll see what happens, you know. So that's how it happened.
Okay, I see.
And then I went to New York and started taking lessons and then became more serious.
That was with Julius Hemphill?
Yeah,
before
Anthony
that.
Braxton and then yes. Julius Hemphill. Yeah.
So what was your experience working, or rather being a student of Anthony Braxton's?
It was great. I mean, it was very normal. I mean, I just saw him recently and we had a long talk about it, his memory of it and mine, and, you know, it was interesting. But it was very straightforward, you know, just like, you know, I was a beginner, you know, so he'd teach me a scale and, you know. And after three lessons, he got quite busy, so he gave me Julius's number, and I called Julius.
That was his idea that you
Julius? Well, I was really into Julius. Mm. I mean, I thought Julius lived on the West Coast. I didn't know he lived in Brooklyn. So then I started a long association with him, and that was great, you know, obviously.
Just being a student of Anthony Braxton's influence you somehow as a composer, did his composing techniques have any influence on you probably later? I would guess.
I mean, his music inspired me for sure. I mean, I was really into him, but we didn't get that far. I mean, lessons were very basic. I mean, we didn't talk about composing. Julius, we talked about everything at once. It was just like this big crazy trip, you know. But I mean, just as an influence, you know, obviously all these guys, Julius, Roscoe Mitchell, Braxton, Henry Threadgill, you know, Leos, all those guys were really big influences, you know. So, I mean, that.
I didn't want to suggest anything, it was just.
No, I mean, you know, the lesson was really, I mean, it was like I was 12 years old. I mean, it was really that basic.
Okay.
So, I mean, of course, we weren't talking about that in the lesson, but, you know, the reason I wanted to study with him is I'm a big fan of his. So, you know, I had met him before and he gave me his number. You know, there was this kind of strange way we met and we just really hit it off, you know.
So I would guess then that your entrance into the jazz world was quite easy for you.
No.
Starting with Anthony Braxton,
that had nothing to do.
Going straight from the basketball field into the jazz.
No, world. But that, I mean, I wasn't playing you know, I was just taking lessons. I mean, that doesn't help anybody. I mean, you know, it was great to be exposed to these guys, but that doesn't mean anything. You still got to work hard, and you know, it's quite hard to get into the whole But the nice thing about Julius was he inspired me to compose. I mean, he really encouraged me, even before I was really ready, you know. So, and also he was a great role model because he was always writing music, and he made it look like very easy, you know. And so I thought, oh, I'm going to do that, you know. And so it definitely made me want to compose. But it's not easy. It wasn't easy. It's still not easy, you know.
So what a lot of people probably ask you is whether recording for ECM meant any changes for you artistically.
Well, yeah, it meant that we would have a fantastic piano. It meant that we would have a fantastic studio, a fantastic producer, excellent distribution, a company that believes in their artists. All of these are not normal. I mean, these are unusual. Like, in my experience, that's doesn't happen all the time. You know, so that was all good. I mean, I know what you want to know, but as far as changing the kind of music I do, no, absolutely not. And anybody who listens to that, I think a lot of people, there are a lot of people who have this kind of weird feeling about ECM, but I personally, if you look at who he's recorded over the years, what he did starting in 1970.
Yes.
I mean, you know, who else has done that and stayed in business and independent, you know, his money. He doesn't have a corporation behind him. You know, everybody else who's tried to do that has either failed or quit, lost interest, you know, because of the struggle. And here's this guy. I mean, he was recording, you know, people, Keith Jarrett, before anybody knew who he was. He was recording Chick Corea. You know, all those guys before anybody really cared about them, you know, and made them all quite successful, or helped make them all quite successful. And you know, Paul Bley, I mean, nobody was recording Paul Bley except himself, you know. And so people kind of overlook this history. And also all the incredibly obscure classical music he records, you know, and I don't know, you just, the list of people, Lester Bowie, Art Ensemble, Chicago, Roscoe Mitchell, you know. So I don't understand, you know, Craig Taborn.
Yes.
Nobody asks Craig Taborn if he made the music easier, you know.
Exactly.
Nobody asks Michael Formanek. Nobody asks Paul Bley, you know. So all of a sudden I'm being asked this question. I don't really, it's almost like my so-called fans don't want me to succeed. That's how it feels to me. It's like, oh, now he's sold out. He's on a real label that actually sells records. Which for me, it's like, God, couldn't be better. You know, I recorded my music the way I want to record it. I worked with a great producer, and now they're selling the record, and I'm touring. You know, I don't see that being bad. That's a positive thing, in my opinion. Or, you know, letting somebody like Matt Mitchell, who he's never even met, go to the Steinway factory and pick out the best piano.
I mean, that's what he did.
Yeah.
Yeah, really?
So, I mean, how can that be seen as a negative thing? I mean, that's, you know, it's a real sign of respect. And so, you know, did he go in and say, okay, I want you to make your music mellow? Of course not. He knows what he's getting into. You know, he knows who I am. And as you can see from the results, it's, you know, it's helped me and it's helped him, you know. And if you listen to, I mean, I don't know how anybody can say I sold, you know, that the music's easier. I mean, it's, you know, it's the same stuff I've been doing all along. You know, it sounds different. It sounds better than some of it. Some of it's, you know, it's, but you can hear every single note the piano's playing. You know, these live records, you can't hear any of that, you know. So it really annoys me because my so-called fans would much rather have me record for $100 with some shitty, you know, two stereo mics and with a lot of no, I mean, I don't understand the mentality, you know, and I know why people are saying this, but nobody asks anybody else that question. You know, it's strange to me.
You know, I wouldn't have asked you had you not provoked me in the beginning.
Well, I don't care. I mean, I'm not accusing you of anything, but it's just interesting to me. Like, last night I did an interview, and the first question was, many people say your music is softer now that you're on ECM. And I'm just, you know, I mean, it's just like, do people really think that would happen after 40 records? I would go in there and say, oh, yeah, sure, yeah, let's just put some strings in there, and, you know, I mean, it's absurd. you know, and especially in light of what I've done, the Torn record,
yes.
the Formanek record, you know, Craig's record. I mean, listen, I mean, of course he didn't do that. I mean, the guy has so much integrity. You know, I can't speak for anybody else, but my experience was he made it really easy for us to make the record I wanted to make, you know, and he was extremely supportive of everyone. And now he's, you know, he's going crazy, so happy. And, you know, it's amazing. I've never had that from a label, you know. I won't, you know, I mean, I've, most of my experiences with labels, is, it's like once the record comes out, everybody just says, oh, this music's too difficult, you know. And they just hang their heads and go, we can't sell this, you know. And that's the end. And for me, you know, selling the record is just as important as making the record. I mean, I'm not doing this so I can have a painting on my wall. You know, I want to have a career. I want to be playing. And if someone's selling records, then you're having concerts. You know, and that's good for everybody. I mean, you'll see. You'll come to the concert. You know, I mean, we're not getting up there. It's not like we're getting up there and we haven't changed anything. You know, it's so... But all the studio records I make are different than what I do live. It's never the same. It can't be. You know, you're playing in a vacuum with headphones, you know. So, I mean, it's absurd to think, you know, if you look at all my records, look at the live ones and the studio ones, it's completely different. You know, the songs are shorter. The sound is better on the studio records. I mean, there's a reason you do them. You know, I make studio records so I can, you know, really bring out the composition, bring out the detail in the sound, because the details make it sound better. You know, if you can hear all the nuances, the clarinet breathing, you know, that's good. You know, I like that. That's what makes the music sound better, you know, more intimate. And that's why we do studio records. You know, if I love doing live records, but it's a different thing. You know, it's like a snapshot. You know, a studio record's like making a movie for me. You know, it's something that's, it's going to last. You know, it has to last. It's built to last. And it's really important to me. You know, I really put a lot of thought into it. And, you know, those tunes, those were the tunes I chose. He didn't even listen to them before we went in. You know, he was like, whatever you do,
you
mean do it. Yeah, until we were in the studio, you know. Same on Formanek's new record. We did another one. He didn't even know what we were going to do. He just like, let's do it. You know, he respects Craig, too. You know. So, I mean, that's how I feel anyway. And I know some people don't even believe me. I mean, there's people who just say, you know, I see these blogs and they think, oh, he's just rationalizing. And it's not like we make a ton, you know, it's not like we're getting paid $50,000 for, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We're not talking about real money here. We're just talking about getting paid, getting the respect, getting treated with the kind of respect that, you know, high-level classical musicians, you know, it's really nice to get that. You know, it makes you feel good about it. It's not the money, you know. We don't get that. I mean, it's not, it's you know, we're getting paid, but it's not a lot of money. I mean, it, you know, compared to most people who have jobs, it's not, oh, you know what I mean.
I wouldn't know.
Well, I know, you're a student, but I mean, the average person.
It's not that I'm student. The radio is just called student.
Yeah. But you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
The average person, you know, the average person working here makes more money than I do. You know, so I mean, it's... It's not about that. You know, people have this perception, and they also have this perception that it's like some kind of corporate label, but it's not. He owns it. He started it. He owns it. It's his money. Does whatever he wants, you know.
So what about the band? Tell me about the band. Was it a difficult choice for you to, let's say, to pick Matt instead of Craig, for instance?
Well, I was finished playing. I mean, me and Craig... You know, he's
You're
doing his own thing. Well, in terms of my groups, yeah.
Yes.
You know, because he's too busy. I mean, you know, that's, we played it out. And so I was looking to get a new band together. And Matt's incredible. I mean,
he is, of course.
He's incredible. I mean, you'll see. I mean, he's, you know, seeing him live and, you know, he's got all the music memorized. He's just amazing. You know, and he's also extremely dedicated. And
he's also playing your compositions unaccompanied, I think. Yes, okay. What about the idea that this was to be a band, a bassless band, which kind of reminds me of
that's not new for me.
But it, in a way, it connects you with one of our younger jazz guitarists, Samo Sharamon. You've worked with him. he also has projects without bass.
Well, I'm pretty sure I've been doing it since like the late 90s. I mean, you know, I don't think I got that idea from him.
No, it's not what I was implying,
but,
no.
Yeah. But I mean, I've been doing this since 1999. I've had bands, or earlier with Big Satan. So yes. I mean, I've been doing this since the middle 90s. It's not really that new an idea for me or for anybody. I did it because I liked how it liberated the drummer. You know, I felt like it turned it into more interactive between all the members of the band, and there was no rhythm section. Everybody was just, you know, in charge of all of that. And so instead of having a bass and drum kind of playing as this thing entity and then the others, now it's like a three-way or four-way conversation. And so that was the initial reason why I did it, to kind of liberate. And also, it gives the drummer more space with their sound because they're not covering up the bass, and, you know, they can use more, be more expressive with the texture and sound. And that's how why I initially did it. And I just like the flexibility. You know, you can sort of sound like a lot of different things. You know, you can sound like, it can sound like a chamber music group. It can sound like a funk. You know, you can do all kinds of stuff. And it's always very transparent, you know, which I like.
A lot of people started describing your music as chamber music. Like, yeah.
You read the press release.
Yes, I did. I did read it also. But it's not just that. I think it's... with the complexity of the compositions.
Yeah, it's true. You know, it's delicate. It's got, it's very delicate. You know, there's a real delicate balance in terms of the orchestration and the instruments, you know, and so it really does have to be balanced like a string quartet. And, I mean, chamber music just means playing in a room, but I understand I understand why people might say that. The clarinet, you know, Oscar's got a beautiful sound. The clarinet and piano is a very classical sound. Chess is playing timpani, you know. Now he's playing vibraphone, although not tonight.
Not tonight.
They couldn't get an instrument, but you know, it's growing in that direction in a good way, you know. I just like the sound of the instruments, the blend. And I did want a situation where it wasn't just a drummer, you know. It was somebody who's playing multiple percussion. And
I think you're also active as a lecturer and a teacher of composition.
Sometimes. I do workshops and stuff, yeah.
Okay, this is enough for my question. But what I would like to know from you is whether focusing on teaching and lecturing about composition makes it... somehow different for you to write music?
Well, I don't do it very often, and I don't really lecture. I mean, I talk, you know.
Okay.
But I mean, I wouldn't want to be a teacher, at least right now. You know, I'd rather do what I'm doing. It doesn't make it difficult. It makes it difficult if it takes up a lot of time, you know, but it doesn't make it difficult to do.
With modern jazz being so... focus on composition these days, I would say that it's somehow connected with the idea that it has to be taught.
Well, there's nothing wrong with it being taught. I mean, everybody has different ways of learning. I mean, I look at teaching as more, I'm not so much showing people what to do, I'm just trying to inspire them to want to do what I'm doing. Or want to, you know, play music or write music. I can describe the process, how it works for me, but I can't instruct someone how to do it. It's really just work. Mm. It's not inspiration, it's work. You have to want
exactly.
to do it,
yeah.
And then you have to sit there and do it. You have to have a lot of patience, and you have to have an affinity for it. You know, you have to understand how to organize things, ideas. That's all you're doing, you're organizing ideas. And then you make decisions like, well, is this good? Is this good? You know, and will this provoke something interesting, or will this promote improvisation? Or, you know, I'm just trying to make something happen, really. And it happens to be related to my world. You know, I like to cause something that maybe wouldn't have happened if they were playing with somebody else, you know.
So I guess then that when you're composing, you have your musicians in mind, the people
you
play with.
Not all the time, but I like to, yeah. It definitely helps.
I guess.
It's like having, it's like painting, you know, you have all these different colors, and it's like, oh, there's Matt Mitchell, he's red, you know, I'll mix that with Oscar, and, you know, see how that works.
He's blue, I guess.
Yeah, I was going to say blue. You know, so, I mean, it's really, you're just organizing sound, and then you have these people, you know, who hopefully are very, have a very personal way of seeing things. You know, I want their opinion. You know, it's like a conversation, and I do want to know what someone else's opinion is. I don't want to be the only, which is what I was saying about Manfred. You know, I don't want to just go in there and tell him what I want to do. And it's a collaboration. You know, it's his label. It's like working with a, you know, it's like I'm directing a movie, but he might be the producer, or, you know, you need the help. I mean, you know, at a certain point, it's just like, you don't want to be like this. You want to be like this, you know.
What about your own label then?
Right now, I'm just selling the stuff, but it's you know, it's money. I mean, everybody's stealing music, so I mean, I can't really make a studio record if I can't sell them. And you know, I can only sell maybe half or a third as much as I used to, because everybody, all these BitTorrent things, and you know, it's crazy. I mean.
But Screwgun is your second label, I think.
Yeah.
Is it true?
Yeah, the first one was Empire.
How long did that last?
I think 4 or 5 records. But, I mean, Screwgun was really fun. I mean, I just don't have the time to do it and the money, you know, to really do it. But who knows? You know, I might maybe do a live record with this band. And I mean, I'm going to talk to him because I'm curious what, you know. He came to our gig the other night, and it was... You know, we played much different material and stuff, and he was really excited. So I wonder if he would let us make a live record even, you know, because he really responded to the, you know, to the live. Otherwise, I'll do it, you know.
Do you plan to continue working with this band?
Yeah.
Okay. This band. So there are a couple of records still in store,
I guess. Yeah. I think so. I hope so.
Okay, so do I. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks.
V Ereš intervjuju se je s Timom Burnom pogovarjal Andrej Hočevar. Tim Burn bo danes ob 8:30 v klubu Cankarjevega doma nastopil svojo zasedbo, v kateri igrajo še Oscar Noriega, Matt Mitchell in Chess Smith. Intervju Radija Študent.